Welcome to the XYZ Experiment. Today we are very excited and intrigued to have a conversation with my friend Ian. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Fiona.
So we are here to chat about all things around diversity and equity and inclusion. But before we get there, Ian, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, thanks, Darsh. So my name's Ian. I'll introduce myself initially with how I have started to introduce myself in a professional setting, but also on my LinkedIn and when I am asked to provide bios for events and other things. So I'm a proud gay man, second generation migrant and person of color. For me, that's who I am. And I'm conscious I'm not in a job interview, but I will go into the professional side. So I work as a senior manager at a major university in Melbourne, NARM. And I love a lot of live music. That's one of my favorite things to do in recent years. That's something I've worked out is brings me joy. And I live in the inner west with my partner, Michael, and our cat, Lulu. But I have only moved to Melbourne in 1999. Prior to that, I lived in Adelaide for a number of years with my parents, who still live there, and my sister as well, who now lives in Ballina in northern New South Wales. And I was born in Canberra, Australia, or Ngunnawal country. Yeah, I think that's what the ACT is. But I only lived there until I was three. Then I moved to Indonesia after that and lived many years there. So all of that, I think, has informed very much who I am now, because I've always grown up or lived in a world where there was a lot of diversity and people from different cultures, because I went to an international school. I lived in a country that wasn't necessarily my cultural heritage, Indonesia, or here even Australia, being of Indian background.
You said that this is your LinkedIn and your other thing. So you'll actually say, I'm a proud gay man on that LinkedIn, will you? This is so authentic.
Well, I just think it's important because I think it speaks to who I am first.
Yeah.
And also it speaks to, I think, how I want to engage with others. And that includes in the workplace or in the professional setting, because I want people to know that this is where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
Rather than I'm coming from the viewpoint of being a senior manager at a university.
Yeah.
Oh, and I love to ride my bike, which I rode here. Yes.
Is it an electric bike or is it a...
No, I'm a bit of a purist that way. I look down my nose at people who ride electric bikes. I think they're not real cyclists. Yeah. They're not putting any effort in. But then a friend of mine who has one did say to me, he explained it to me, which made me feel a bit more, okay, maybe it's not so bad. It's essentially, you're still having to exert effort. And it's only when you're going up a hill that it then kicks in. And so then you're riding, you still have to push. It doesn't become like a motorbike where you don't have to do anything.
So what generation do you belong to?
So I belong to Generation X. People tend to think I'm younger than I am.
Yeah.
But also I was born in the later part of Gen X, so in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. But I'm still very Gen X. And as what's been interesting for me is over my life, especially, you know, once I became an adult, I found I gravitated towards older people anyway.
Mm.
I just found I connected with them better and I was more interested in sitting and talking about ideas with them. I think for me, it just felt more comfortable and does feel more comfortable.
So apart from, I guess, gravitating towards people who are older, Gen X onwards, what is the most Gen X thing about you?
Well, one thing I find Gen X is the kind of, I really like live music. I went to a gig last night. We went and saw Mia Dyson. The crowd was not a millennial or a Gen Z crowd. It was an older crowd. In fact, we ended up sitting together with, this was really interesting. We went to the corner and every time I've been to the corner to see a gig, it's always been standing. This time there was cabaret seating in the front. So we sat for the entire gig, which is lovely. So nice. But we ended up sitting with an older couple and we connected so well, bonded, and that was lovely. So I guess for me, the Gen X thing is, yeah, exactly, Fiona, the music I listen to.
The live music for sure.
Yeah, I love that. Probably also the fact that I very, very distinctly remember the 80s, because I grew up in the 80s, but I was old enough in the 80s to actually remember it very well, very distinctly. Especially what I find fascinating is, because I went to an international school in Jakarta all through the 80s, and it was a lot American teachers, a lot of American students. So essentially we all started speaking with American accents, but that also meant that a lot of what we, I guess, thought of as pop culture was American pop culture. So American artists, people like Debbie Gibson and Wilson Phillips and those kinds of bands.
No idea who these people are.
Well, there you go.
Oh, surely you do.
Oh, you must know Wilson Phillips.
Yeah.
No. Do I? Say a song.
Hold On is one of their most famous. I'm not going to sing it for you because I will butcher it.
Maybe
Hold On for One More Day.
That's I have heard that song. Yeah.
Because have you seen Bridesmaids?
Yes.
The film?
Yes.
So that's a very...
That's Wilson Phillips at the end.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
See, I feel like I would only know that by recognition, but I wouldn't be like, oh, that's Wilson Phillips. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you'd know the song if you heard it.
Yeah. I just don't know the artist.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, that the 80s, I think for me, because I remember them so well, is the other thing that probably makes me feel very Gen X.
Yeah. So funny because he says it, the other Gen X in room immediately knows.
I know. And just like watching both of you, you know, you're talking about live music, you're both nodding. Yes, the Gen Xers are connecting in the room. And me, it's a Gen Y sitting there going, what is wrong with these guys?
I don't know who Wilson Phillips is.
I know. I was That's quite bizarre. Surprised.
Look, guys, I also don't have a great repertoire with, like, pop culture, and I listen to Rachmaninoff's Concerto 3 on the way in here, like, I'm probably, like, not your typical.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because when I was studying for my exams in year 12, one thing I made a habit was of getting up early and studying, listening to Classic FM.
Yes.
And that stayed with me. Classic FM. Yeah, so do I. That's down. I still listen to it a lot when I'm working and doing things, so... Yeah, which I think music can put you in a category, but we're all so different that sometimes we'll stray out of that as well. You know, so, you know, Wilson Phillips, live music, Mia Dyson, but then another favourite artist of mine is Kylie Minogue.
So I'm interested, and I know this wasn't on the question sheet, but were there anything else that stood out to you from growing up in the 80s that made a profound impact on you?
Probably the politics of the world at the time.
Mm.
So that was when the USSR was an entity. And I still remember always, like, you know, we used to get Time magazine at home. And there was always something about the USSR, but the US, there was the Cold War was a thing then as well. So the politics of the world seemed so, and there's still so much tension and stuff going on, but it was a very different politics then, I feel. There was very...
That was Reagan and Gorbachev, wasn't
it? Yeah. And it was a very distinct time. I mean, what's interesting is because I grew up in Indonesia, in Jakarta, so I didn't, but I didn't necessarily connect with the politics or the place of, because I went to an international school and I had kind of that experience of living there, but having an existence which was not living as a local.
Yeah.
So very much looking more at the world and the politics then. I guess I'm reflecting now. I don't think as a child I necessarily thought about the politics, but when I think about the 80s, that's what I remember is... You know, the USSR for some reason sticks out.
Well, that's when the wall came down.
Mm, and the wall came down in Berlin, like, in 1997. Yeah. So that for me sticks up for the 80s. And then there's the 80s as they were defined in the US, because again, as I said before, there was so much of my life going to that school that was American based. So there were things like Cabbage Patch Dolls and Trapper Keepers, which are American. Icons of consumerism in the 80s. The students at the school very much subscribed to that. So that's what I remember from the 80s as well. And I think what's fascinating is because I didn't grow up here in Australia, people listening to this or people I talk to from the 80s have very different things they remember from the 80s.
Yeah, interesting.
Than I did.
My first toy that I got gifted by my parents when I was in Australia as a 3-year-old was a Cabbage Patch Kid.
Oh, okay, so it did get here. Well, I think it would.
What year were you three?
Well, we came to Australia when I was 1987, so I think I was 3.5.
During that time.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
My sister had a Cabbage Patch Doll. She's a Gen X. She just turned 50. I didn't want one. I was too old by then for me, but for her, she really wanted one.
And then they had the different races eventually.
Yeah. Yes! Yeah.
Did you get a brown one?
No, I got a white one, but I would have loved a brown one. So we might get into some of the main interview questions when we're really going to chat with you about diversity and inclusion and equity. And you have a real passion for this area. And we've heard a little bit from your introduction, but What do you feel are the life experiences that have led to this passion?
Probably quite a few. So firstly, I think, so as I said before, I was born in Canberra and lived there till I was three, so very young. So that probably, and I don't remember that at all, that time. But moved to Indonesia. And Indonesia was a very insightful experience for me when I reflect on it now. So I moved there when I was four and I left when I was 15. And that whole time I went to an international school. I had friends from China, I had friends from the Philippines, friends from the US, friends from Canada, friends from New Zealand, friends from Australia, friends from India, but a whole range. But what was fascinating is we all went to the school, and because the school was very much it focused on the US curriculum, it also had a lot of American teachers, it had a lot of American students, by osmosis or whatever, we all started speaking with the same accent, which was an American accent.
Mm.
What's funny is I think people around the world who've been to international schools always talk about the fact that it's a distinctive American accent. It's not one from New York or the Midwest or Texas. It's a specific American accent, probably formed partly because there's different, I guess, for want of a better term, different parts of America represented at these international schools, because there's teachers from different parts, there's students from different parts. But it's a very distinctive international school American accent, which is quite funny. But what I found fascinating is we were people from all these different cultures and parts of the world, but we all spoke with the same accent. So I think that for me was a seminal formation of my interest in diversity, equity, and inclusion. But at the time, I probably wouldn't have recognized that. But it was so almost matter of fact. It didn't seem odd to me or different or strange that I had friends from, you know, so many different countries, that I was going to school in a country that I wasn't born in, or that my family didn't grow up, like my parents didn't grow up in. So none of that seemed unusual. It seemed fairly standard.
Can I ask a question about that? Because you've got so many people from different nationalities. The commonality was the language, like you all spoke in the same sort of similar language, and there was a focal point for that, or?
Yeah, so it was an English medium school.
Yeah.
So we all had to learn English. Yeah. The other piece of it, which spoke to, I guess, where we were living and where the school was situated, was the fact that the government required us to also learn Bahasa Indonesia,
okay.
which is a local
okay.
language. Yeah. So we all learned that as well,
which
was fantastic. And I'm so pleased that that was a requirement. But when I lived there in the 80s, most people who were there from other nationalities, expats, had lived in a way such that they had servants. They usually would have a driver, they might have a gardener, they live in big houses. But these were local people who did those jobs. So learning Bahasa Indonesia for me was fantastic, because it meant I could talk to those people and actually form a relationship with them. And I do remember, for me, that was one of the things I enjoyed most, was actually forming relationships with, you know, the hired help, for want of a better term. Going back to your question, there was that commonality, but I think it just created this common purpose. And it was a very specific way of living, I think, compared to, like, say, if I'd been raised in Australia. I know, like, every place is different, obviously, but I remember when I'd go to India every summer with my family, the life there was very different to the life I knew in Indonesia. And as a child, as I said before, the life in Indonesia, what I knew and what I enjoyed. And so going to India wasn't always necessarily an enjoyable experience for me, because it wasn't what I knew and it was jarring. Yeah, that was the common experience for all of us in the school, I think. And a lot of the students actually would have moved countries quite a bit, so they would have gone to other international schools as well.
What was jarring about going back to India from then a country like Indonesia?
It was not necessarily the difference between Indonesia and India, although there are a lot of differences. It was more the life I had in Indonesia, so the life of comfort. And I guess, you know, the creature comforts were much more prominent than they were maybe in India. India in the 80s, for me, there was a lot. For example, I remember there would always be what they call in India load shedding, which is essentially what it means, shedding load. So I think shedding electrical load, probably. But it meant there was always light, like lights would always go out. Power would always go out all the time. And India being, because we would go in summer, so I'm a Northern Hemisphere summer, so June, July, August, it would be really hot in India. So that would be quite uncomfortable when there's no fans running. A, B, we'd always be bitten by mosquitoes.
Yes.
And C, there was always a lot of cockroaches everywhere and things. So, you know, like little things, if you think about it, maybe. And when I think about it now, but I didn't necessarily, I enjoyed seeing my family there and I have a lot of family in India, but there's a film actually called The Namesake, which is based on a book by Jhumpa Lahiri, who's an American writer who now lives in Italy. And it very much speaks to my experience because it's written from the viewpoint of Bengali migrants. So my Indian heritage is, I'm Bengali. Her book speaks to the experience of Bengali migrants in the US.
Yeah.
And in the film, but also in the book, the family, so the kids are born and brought up in the US, but the family goes to India for a visit. And in the film, especially, I remember the way it was portrayed very much spoke to my experience where we'd go back and I'm like, oh, it's so hot. Oh, it's so uncomfortable. And, you know, and it was so different to what I knew. Which is fascinating because in the film, they were going from the US to India, which is a very different experience, going from a Western country to India. Whereas for me, I was going from a Southeast Asian country, so another Asian country, to India. But I guess it's, the life I had in Indonesia, which was the life of comfort and the somewhat, I don't want to say the word artificial, but it was not I wasn't living like a local in Indonesia.
Yeah.
So that was, for me, was probably what was jarring. In addition to the experience of going to the international school, there were other experience probably that did inform my interest in DEI at that time was we, in the school, there was a group called Tolong Anak Anak, which means help the children. And it was a volunteer-run group that would undertake community service, raise funds, but also go into villages and slums in Indonesia. To, you know, connect, but also to build better capacity and improve the lives and experiences of people in those areas. And students could volunteer for it if they chose to. And so I did. And I remember going to villages and slums and helping build things, but also just really enjoying the experience. And I think for me, that was quite seminal as well in informing my interest in diversity, equity, and inclusion, because I saw how they were living, which was different to how I was living. But I formed that connection and I recognized that everyone's different and everyone has a different experience, but every experience is valid and every life has value. And so for me, that was, and the same could be said for when I'd go to India, because I know I'd go to India and I'd see children in slums and they'd be playing very happily with, you know, a piece of string or a box or something, which, you know, because they wouldn't have access to necessarily the traditional toys and things, but they were so happy. And so, yeah, so we left Indonesia and moved to Adelaide because my father got a job at the university, at one of the universities there. And I went to high school there. And that was an interesting experience. Me and my family, we looked around at different schools. And one of the things I wanted to do was make sure I could do the International Baccalaureate, which is an international educational qualification for year 11 and 12. I think now it is done for earlier years as well. And it was only one school in Adelaide that offered it as a public school. And so we went to the school, met with the assistant principal there. And my whole family was with me. And I remember her saying, she was going through how I would start the school year. So because I started halfway through the year as well, I remember that. She was talking about, you know, the different things that I would get started on. And then she said, oh, and we've enrolled you in the ESL class, the English as a Second Language class. And I think my whole family was like, what? Because I'd grown up speaking English. It's one of the first languages I spoke. I remember particularly my sister was especially like, why would you do that? And she took the assistant principal to task. And she couldn't really properly answer the question without it coming across as racist.
Yeah.
Saying, because you're obviously the way you look and the fact that you've come from Indonesia. So you obviously can't speak English very well, despite the fact that we had just spent probably half an hour prior to her saying this, speaking in really good English.
Yeah.
And she had no trouble understanding us and we had no trouble understanding her. So it was quite an interesting experience, especially at my sister's outrage. We were all out, but my sister vocalized it. And I think she made her really uncomfortable. But in the end, then they enrolled me in the advanced English class instead, and which I topped at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So that was a fascinating experience for me. And again, it spoke to immediately the fact that we, when we make assumptions about people, we very much go with what we know and we rely on our own privilege that we don't think about other people's experience. So we just automatically think, well, I'll just pigeonhole you into that group. So I'll put you into an ESL class because obviously you won't speak English well because of the way you look.
Yeah.
She would be dying, like, in that interview when your sister took her to task. In her own head, she must have just been thinking, oh, I've really stuffed this up, like, as in...
Yeah, I think she... Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly, but I do remember there was a lot of squirming going
on. Yeah, yeah, she would have been dying, because it is racist.
I mean, yeah, yeah, I mean, what else could you call it?
Would have been better for her just to say, oh, my God, I've made an assumption.
Which English class would you like to be enrolled in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or give me the choice to make the choice.
Yeah.
Just to make the assumption.
Yeah, to make the assumption. And you know, I mean, I think I did fairly well at that school through the years I was there. But even the fact that I started halfway through the school year and managed fine, and the fact that, you know, I topped the advanced English class, but the fact that I'd just come from an international school where the language of instruction was English.
Yeah.
It was bizarre to me. It was really bizarre. In fact, it was bizarre because all the facts pointed to not enroll me in an ESL class. Yet she used her prejudice and her assumptions to do what she did.
Yeah.
When you were talking about, you know, living in a country and kind of, I think one of your reflections in terms of not everyone living in this one space has the same experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really powerful element of diversity that we don't necessarily... Yeah. Reflect on, and even in Australia, you sit there and think, there's such a varied experience of lived experience across our country.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, there's a varied experience living in an expat community compared to living as a local in Indonesia, but then going back to India and who you are coming in into, going back to India and who you are coming in as someone who's not living there and, you know, all of those types of things. Very different experience yet again.
Yeah, so I think, it's that whole experience of, and this, I mean, you've asked me the question of where my passion for diversity, equity, and inclusion comes from. And I've reflected on that a lot because I get asked that quite a bit. And I also wonder why it is that I have such a passion for it without necessarily, I think a lot of people tend to think they should behave a certain way or have certain interests. So, they might feel that, oh, it's good if I donate to this organization every year or things like that. But for me, with diversity, equity, inclusion, it just seems to be so, it's a no-brainer for me. Like, it's almost like I can't not be interested in this and I can't not advocate for better, celebrating diversity and building equity and, you know, building inclusion. Because for me, it just makes so much sense. I occasionally find it challenging to discuss why I have such a strong interest in this space, but I think for me it's just because it's so logical. So as an example, and I think I mentioned my sister before and how she took the assistant principal to task, but she's always been very influential in my life. I've always looked up to her. She's always had a strong kind of approach of social justice, and my parents do as well. And I think for me, the social justice as well came from Indonesia and seeing how people lived in slums and trying to help them, but also going to India and seeing it as well. But she very much is a strong advocate for gender equity. She's a very strong feminist, and that had a huge impact on me. And you know, there's things where I just don't understand how it is that even today, after so many years, women still are still not given the same rights as men.
Mm.
Women still cannot walk alone at night or walk alone in general sometimes, even in broad daylight, and not keep having to look over their shoulder and not worry about being attacked. Especially in a country like Australia, which apparently we've got police, we're meant to be a civilized society where everyone has rights and they should feel safe and respected. And I remember posting something on social media, which was essentially saying, it was telling a little story saying, tonight I did this, I put my headphones in, I walked to my destination, I did it without having to look, you know, past dark alleyways and past crowds of people, I didn't feel afraid, I could do it without, you know, giving a second glance. That's what freedom looks like, and yes, I'm a man. Women are not free in this country, and other people as well. I mean, you know, queer people are not free. You know, anyone who is being discriminated against and then experiences harassment or abuse or violence as a result of what they look like, their gender, their ability, anything, means they're not free because they're not free to be who they are. So they will pretend to be someone else, or they'll just try and fit the status quo. They won't put their head above water or head above the parapet because they don't want to be seen and then be the object of potential abuse or ridicule or discrimination. And what kind of life is that? What kind of life is that where you can't actually achieve what you want to achieve because you're constantly being cut down, or you don't know what someone will say, so you're always second-guessing yourself? And so for me, I mean, I think that's one of the things I'm most keen to push with the diversity, equity, inclusion agenda, is that everyone deserves the best opportunities they can get, and everyone should be supported for that and be given the agency and the power for themselves to do it on their terms without anyone telling them how to do it, supporting them to do it in a way that works for them, but not telling them how to do it. That's one of the reasons I'm such a strong advocate for it. But also, I think because it creates so much opportunity for diverse thought. If we have people from different backgrounds, they will bring different ideas to the table. They'll bring different ideas to any kind of process or work piece or anything like that. And as a result, there'll be new ideas that might, you look at something differently and suddenly you innovate and you might be able to solve a problem because someone else's viewpoint has come in and you didn't see it that way. And so it moves things forward in organizations and communities. But people still don't see that because people are so worried and scared about what they will lose, or that their own intrinsic who they are is being eaten away at because someone different is coming in and offering something different. But I don't understand why people have to feel so afraid of difference and diversity, and what is, unless it's being used to attack. What is the risk of actually respecting someone else and actually respecting who they are and learning from them and being open to new ideas, which will then help you because potentially you might not have seen it that way, and it gives you a new viewpoint to actually try something different.
So on that, like, that's probably what you're articulating there, one of the big challenges that the diversity, equity and inclusion space is facing. And in your experience, do you feel we currently have the tools, the knowledge, the expertise to have those conversations?
No, because I think, I mean, for me, having, I guess, been passionate and been doing work in this space for a number of years now, I've noticed I don't think it's unique to diversity, equity, inclusion. I think any kind of movement or social movement or any kind of, I'll use the example of project management, for example, the concept of project management and the fact that there's all these courses you can do, there's Prince 2 certification, but what that brings with it is a lot of language, specific terms, terminology, jargon that go with that. So if you're a good project manager, you know about, you know, Gantt charts, you know about, you know, the different bits and pieces that go with it. In the same way, diversity, equity, inclusion, I think, suffers from an overcomplication of what it actually is. The fact that we use words like diversity, equity, inclusion, the fact that we use words like intersectionality, they're all big terms. And those of us in the sector understand what they are, and we can talk about it confidently, but those from outside the sector do not. And it's very alienating for someone from outside the sector of diversity, equity, inclusion, or someone, for example, a CEO of a company who has to be conscious of so many different things, like the bottom line, staffing, putting something out to market and making sure it actually delivers, all of those things. They don't actually have time to then also think, oh, and now I have to make sure I tick the box so we have enough women on our board, or that we've actually running programs so we better support queer people in the workplace. All of these things become an added burden because it's just another thing they have to think about. And so it's actually really challenging for them to then actually give diversity, equity, inclusion what I think is the attention it deserves, because they don't see it as core business. They don't see it as enabling the performance of the organization. And I think part of the reason that happens is because people don't necessarily identify with it, because there's all these terms that are used. And that's, I think, where we really need to get to in the diversity, equity, inclusion space, is breaking down the jargon, breaking down the terminology, and just making it accessible and making it real to people to say, this is why you do what you do, why we do what we do, and helping them see the sense of it. People will actually identify with it, and they'll be more willing to embrace it as core business and as an enabling approach and framework that they can get behind.
Can I say something really cynical? I just really would like to know what you two think of this. It seems to me, you said something earlier about people just aren't engaging and all that sort of stuff, right? But if they have a good slogan, they do, like Black Lives Matter and Me Too.
Mm.
I know I'm being very cynical saying that. Do you just need a good slogan? Like, it sounds ridiculous to say, but that's when it seems people get onto that bandwagon. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, for me, what that speaks to is the fact that people will identify with something if it's catchy and simple and it really has strong messaging. So we were talking before about the referendum for the Voice to Parliament last year and the fact that the No camp had a very effective slogan, which was, if you don't know, vote no.
Mm.
Now, you know, that is so powerful because A, it rhymes. It's got this kind of alliteration almost. If you don't know, vote no. It just rolls off. And so people will immediately go, I remember that message.
Yeah.
Whereas the Yes camp had all these different messages and there was not one cohesive message that cut through. And a lot of people who've talked about the referendum since have used that as one thing that derailed the Yes camp, but also empowered the No camp. And that's why they were so effective. So I think for me, yes, slogans are important, but the reason they're important, the reason they're so effective is because, again, they're simple. People understand them and they can identify with them. So I think it still actually speaks to what I was talking about, which is where if you can make it simple, if you can actually demonstrate how diversity, equity, inclusion actually is a good framework to get behind and put it in simple terms, I think it works really effectively. One thing I'm a strong believer in is the fact that at the end of the day, if you practice and it can ensure, it can demonstrate true respect for another person or an organization or an individual or a community where you actually understand, you want to understand where they're coming from, their background, and you actually respect that, as in you give them the space and the voice so they can put that forward, and then you treat them equally, or you treat them with respect, as in you treat them in a collaborative and friendly manner, then I think all the other things will fall into place.
Mm.
So I think respect underpins all of the things. Yeah. It underpins true embracing diversity. It underpins how we make sure we ensure equity, because we then respect where they're coming from so we can make things work for them so they can reach their true potentials. That creates equity and it creates inclusion, because you bring in people from different different backgrounds and viewpoints. So it builds inclusion. So respect for me is where it all begins.
Mm.
But what I find, again, going back to your point about slogans, respect has been co-opted as the terminology for how we want to reduce violence against women and people from gender diverse backgrounds. And I get that. And it should be about respect. But, you know, for example, our universities around the country next week is called Respect at Work?
Yeah,
Respect at Work Week. And it's all around safety for women and it's around how you respect boundaries. It's about how you respect if someone says no, they mean no. If a woman says no, it's about consent. And I think that's all incredibly important. But respect has become almost associated with that, whereas it should actually underpin all of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I think going back to your point, slogans do make a difference, but it's because they're simple and effective and they cut through. And that's what we need to do in the DEI space as well. We need to cut through and not have all these jargon, or all this terminology we get behind, and just put it in simple terms that people understand. I think that would make a real difference.
But I think one of the things that, you know, even just reflecting on some of the stuff that you've been sharing with us today, and going back to your introduction, right? You started with who you are and then what you do. And I feel like maybe in the workplaces and where we're trying to practice diversity, equity, and inclusion, we always start with the what. And then we think, oh, but who can do that? And maybe we don't necessarily recognize all the different elements of who, right? And, you know, intersectionality, very jargonistic word. But at its core, it's about recognizing all the elements that make us the who, and we don't give space for that conversation at work. And I think sometimes when that conversation does happen at work, it happens in the negative when something has gone wrong. And my feeling is that then that puts people on a back foot, because they think, oh, you're only bringing this up because something bad has happened, and so it's always in a negative narrative. And like, as another example, it's like when you have anti-racism groups, like it's such a negatively framed name. Like, why are we calling something anti-racist? Because it's going to get everyone offside because they don't want to be called racist. But we want to have a conversation about race. So I liked how you said, I'm a second generation migrant and I'm a person of colour. Can we start there instead of then saying, I'm here to have an anti-racism conversation with you?
No, I agree. And I think what you just said then about using the term anti-racism, it is possible to try and combat racism and to combat people being xenophobic and people being afraid of something different or diversity or people from other backgrounds or cultures or abilities or sexualities or genders. If we go back to the concept of respect, so you can have a respectful conversation around with someone else and say, what you did then was racist and here's why, and show them and explain to them and have a conversation that's collaborative and open to their viewpoints, but do it in a way which allows each person to have a say and actually allows them to actually, it's how you build understanding, really.
Yeah.
Through true respect. And so, yeah, I agree. Anti-racism is very confronting. But I will say, but it speaks to the concept of disruption, I think, as well. And I think that's so critical. I think while we all, in diversity, equity, and inclusion circles, there's a lot of talk about belonging and about needing everyone should be able to belong to an organization or should feel like they belong. And in recent times, I've been reflecting on the concept of belonging. And for me, because when you belong or when someone belongs to something, they're owned. It's an ownership piece as well. And I understand the way belonging is used in diversity, equity, inclusion is very much how someone feels. So they feel like they belong. So it's not necessarily around someone else owning because you yourself feel like you belong. But it still sits not quite right with me because to me it speaks to the concept of ownership. Like you belong to something. So you belong to a single thing. Or maybe it might be, you know, an organization that has a lot of diverse people, but it is the organization. So you have to almost toe a line.
Mm.
Whereas for me, the concept of inclusion, which is a much more, it's a much better term and a much better way of looking at it because you include diverse viewpoints and include different people, but they don't necessarily have to all belong to the one organization. And that gives them, hopefully, the space and the feeling of psychological safety enough, depending on the organization, that they can then question the status quo, that they can question an organization and say, you know, I don't believe that policy is supportive of women, or I don't believe, you know, this framework that you've got, or the way that someone was treated was respectful of my identity as a queer person. Mm. So I think inclusion is much more powerful and much more effective a term than belonging. And again, going back to the term of respect, I think if you have a respectful setting, a respectful dialogue, if you have respect between two people or between an organization, between communities, then it will always mean people's viewpoints will be included or at least listened to. And that way then people can feel that they actually, they are able to be themselves and that they are of value. If you're not allowed to be yourself, it means you're invisible and you're not seen for who you are. And it creates a monochromatic, like a single viewpoint or only a few viewpoints are represented.
Can I bring a generational lens to this?
Yeah.
If that's okay. So my thoughts are when you're talking about in the workplace and things like that, that depending what generation you are, would have an influence on this. So for me, being a Gen X, and I think the boomers as well, culturally, we were brought up with movies where the bad guys had people with accents and persons of colour. So we were brought up with those types of films. We were brought up with books and films of women who said no, but really they meant yes. You know, all of these really wrong messagings that are deep within us. And so I think when we go into the workplace, we're bringing a lot of that without even realising in our heads. Or like, if I can say it, like the gay person's the person who always brings levity to the situation and makes it funny. And, you know, it's such stereotypes
that
I can look back in films from the 80s and think, oh, my God, like cringe. Even now, things like 50 Shades of Grey, where she really does want it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is one of the biggest selling books of all time. But Are Gen Z's different, do you think? Do you think the younger people are getting... Because I do. I think they're getting this message a lot better than us. And maybe we're not so great now, but do we think in the next generations coming through that these leaderships will be a lot better at that? Like, it's going to... Like, we need a generational change in our leadership roles.
I agree. I completely agree. I think it is generational. I think, you know, I can think of so many examples of people from Gen Z who are actually... have a strong outlook of social justice and what they see as right and wrong and actually making life better for everyone and respecting. So Chanel Contos, for example, is Gen Z. And she's a young woman who has been fighting for gender equity, but also trying to change the narrative and trying to change the structures that we have in society in Australia around consent and around rape and around sexual harassment and sexual assault. Greta Thunberg.
Yeah.
Another young woman who is fighting for climate justice and climate change, fighting against climate change and holding governments and really powerful, and I'll say it, powerful people white like men
Andrew
to account.
Tate. Yeah. That's one of my favorite things she did.
Yeah. So, and it's what I love about it is, and look, I will say it, what I love about it is, it's actually mainly women, young women who are fighting these fights. There are men, and there are young men who are doing it too. But I actually think it's partly, and this is why I have so much respect for women, is that despite the many, many, many years of being oppressed, the many, many years of being harassed, raped, victimized, looked over at work, all of these things, they fight the fight and they will support others. You know, I was talking last night with some people about the fact that there's a reason in the Pride March and at the Mardi Gras, Dykes on Bikes actually leads.
Mm.
And it's because during the AIDS crisis, lesbians were not affected because a lot of them weren't contracting the virus, but their friends and the community was being decimated, you know, and they supported gay men and they fought for gay men to get better access to medication and to have better care. And so for me, and again, these are women or people identify as women. So for me, I think it's so powerful. And that's what I love about the younger generation, because for them it's a no-brainer.
That's
you know,
right. That's being my queer exact word I would is think. Not no-brainer.
Yeah, being queer is not. It doesn't seem unusual at all.
Yeah.
Or being disabled doesn't seem unusual at all. Or fighting for climate justice is actually critical and needed. But I going back to my point about women, how they've set the tone and they're always leading in this space. I think though there needs to be recognition as well that people who have been, you know, and I think this speaks to how I opened and how I introduced myself as being. You know, a person of color, a second generation migrant, and a queer man. So we go back to the terms of intersectionality, that those are my intersectional identities. So my identity as a queer man intersects with my identity as a person of color, which intersects with my identity as a second generation migrant. So those are my intersectionalities. But it's always, I find, I've only seen a few people coming from a position of privilege who actually then are willing to step outside that to fight for proper diversity, equity, inclusion. And so it's always often people of color or people who are coming from groups that have been traditionally discriminated against that fight the fight for diversity, equity, inclusion. So as an example, women are constantly fighting for this, or people of color are trying to fight for change. And it's exhausting. Like, you know, we have to educate others about our experience or the experience of our communities. Because no one else will listen. Whereas the people who actually have the power to make change, i.e. white people, and often, you know, white males, just don't listen or think it's just a nice to have or just some piddly little thing on the side that it's just some little noise that they can just shut down with some, you know, cupcakes and box ticking and say, oh yeah, we've met our quota for women on a board.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting, you know, it's why is it always the people who have already been discriminated against who have to keep fighting for ending discrimination against their own groups, but other groups as well.
And then that causes problems too.
Yeah.
You know, because then your voice is too loud.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
which is ridiculous.
You're too much of a disruptor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think back to that point that, you know, do the people in power, the white men, in many cases, see it, recognize it, then know how to fight for it. Maybe chatting about unconscious bias, right? And also... I know I've shared with you before that story Deborah Frances White shared on her podcast around corridors and doors. And for many people who are in positions of privilege or power, they're walking down corridors. There's nothing getting in the way for them. Whereas for people who have intersectionality or have areas of vulnerability or marginalization, we're coming across a door that we need to be banging against or working out how to open this. But if you've never had to walk through that door or open that door is invisible. Like, it's not even on your radar and very hard to recognize. And so then when potentially we bring it up and say, hey, by the way, I had to like really bang hard on this door, they're like, well, that wasn't my experience. I just sailed through. Like, that might be just something wrong with you, as opposed to there was a system that made that door there for you that doesn't recognize or see you to let that door open for you.
Because I almost feel like if you say the word unconscious bias to a certain age group, you can hear the groan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's the, and you raised the point before about the generational lens. So people, you know, Gen X and boomers, and you know, I would say probably some Gen Y as well, were raised with the fact that, you know, women, you know, say no, but they actually mean yes. Yeah. So, you know, like there's certain cultures and groups are inherently bad or inferior and all of those things. And I think it speaks to the fact that for me, the diversity, equity, inclusion, you know, approaches we take, for some reason, it's always the same. It's always workshops. It's always, you know, talking about unconscious bias. It's always talking about it's training and development. It's it's compliance. Mm. So as an example, I know I talked to a senior academic at another university, which I'm not at anymore, but I was. And he and I were discussing, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And he was saying, we always have to sit through these workshops where, and this was around, you know, sexual harassment and consent. And these workshops are always delivered by lawyers who are talking about it from the perspective of, you know what you can and can't do. If you do this, then you will be, you're breaking the law or you're breaking some rule. And that's a terrible approach to take, because then no one's going to want to think about, you know, it's like a stick. So, oh, I guess I have to, like, treat women equally, otherwise I'll be, you know, hauled before some panel or something.
How do you think they react if someone in that office space got up and told their story of what had happened in that office space?
Well, I mean, I think that would be powerful to an extent. I think I've been in rooms where, you know, people in power, and I'll say it, it's often usually white men in power, say, oh, I don't think that's a problem because I haven't heard much about it.
Yeah.
And that, for me, that again...
And just, that's a problem immediately, it's that a you problem haven't immediately, heard about it.
A, you haven't heard about it, but B, what I think needs to be recognized is the reason you haven't heard about it is because no one feels safe to say anything.
Yeah.
If it's happened to them, why would they want to bring it up? They're reliving old memories. They don't feel safe in the workplace as it is because something's happened to them. So they're not going to report it.
Because it singles them out even more.
Yeah.
Even then, more.
Exactly.
More bias.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, a lot of women have talked about, there's so many stories of women who don't want to raise an issue because they know if they do, there'll be repercussions. They might not be treated. They might not be brought into a project because they're seen as a difficult woman or someone who's, you know, and I think it's really frustrating because the people in power have privilege and they should be using that privilege to help others who don't have that privilege. I mean, that for me is the crux of so much of where diversity, equity, and inclusion should start from. The people in power should be the ones driving it, not the people who have already been discriminated against, who are continually just fighting for a fairer and more equitable world. It should be the people who are people at positions of power, and they should see why and they should understand why. And it's about supporting, you know, your staff or supporting the people in your organization or in your community to reach their full potential and learning from them. You know, I'm a big believer in the fact that I'm in a position of privilege. I know that as a man. So I want to use that privilege to help women and gender diverse people who don't enjoy the same privileges of being a man and recognize what they're going through. But also what's key for me is helping, being informed by their voices. So how they want the world to be or how they want things to be better for them. So I'm a big believer in amplifying others' voices and not using my own and creating space for people and not taking it up with my own. I think that's what we all need to do. Anyone in a position of privilege needs to recognize that actually what your experience is not the same as someone else's. So there's a great quote from a gentleman called David Gator, who's a US, and I think he was, I think he's still around, and I think he worked in the computer science industry, but the quote I love by him is that privilege is when you think something is not a problem because it's not a problem to you personally. And that just, you know, nails it. You know, so many people don't recognize that everyone's going through something, and we only have to respect what they're going through and listen to them and understand what they're going through. And we want to help them, get them to inform us how we can help them. So it's most effective. Which again, for me, is also what allyship is all about. A good ally is not something you are, it's something you learn over time, but you also just continually have to learn from others and give them the voice and the space to do it.
Like, it's so interesting because I love that quote, and it speaks to, did you watch that movie Hidden Figures?
Yeah.
And how she was this black woman who was an incredible mathematician, was getting into trouble because there wasn't a female toilet in her building.
For
coloured people. So she had to traipse across this campus to go to the toilet.
Over a kilometre.
And come back. And then this white man, her boss, was like, where are you going all the time? And it wasn't until she raised it to his consciousness to say, there isn't a toilet for me here. And so I have to
traipse. And you won't even share the coffee pot with me.
No. And then, like, just the realisation on all of their faces, like, we didn't even see this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fascinating how people are so blind.
So blind.
And privilege is very blinding. Privilege puts blinkers on everyone, because the minute you're born in with privilege or you're in a privileged group, why would you want to disrupt that for your own comfort? Why would you want to disrupt your own comfort or your own position to help someone else or to, you know, because you're fine.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. And look, I'd say probably in the world today, with things that are going on, but also, you know, in Australia, I think we're a very individualistic society. I think we care about ourselves first and communities second. Not everyone, but I think that's an overriding narrative for a lot of people. Whereas when I compare it to, for example, my Indian background, and everyone's always looking out for everyone else, and there's always families always look out for one another, and there's much more a focus on the collective or the individual. So I think that's also, that in itself helps dismantle privilege, because you're always thinking about other people. And so your privilege is not dictating everything all the time.
So I guess looking forward, so that we don't leave our listeners depressed.
I think Gen Z is going to get us through this.
I was just going to say, what do you see as the future for DEI?
I'm hoping I see the future as more conversations with people who don't traditionally have these conversations.
Mm.
So I go to a lot of groups around. I go to webinars and I go to focus groups and I go to events around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And always I find the majority of the people in the room are people from human resources or people in culture from HR.
Right.
Yes, DEI has always been parked in that area, but I think it actually needs to be, I do find leaders are there as well, a lot as well, but it needs to be everyone. It needs to be everyone in the organization from all levels who go to these kinds of events, and they need to understand why it makes a lot of sense to be focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion in terms that they understand, in ways that they can access and engage with. So then they can go, actually, I do need to think about that woman down the hall who's having a hard time of it because she's got childcare responsibilities as well as having to, you know, hold down a job. What can I do? Well, maybe I should talk to her and she can tell me what she might need and things like that. So just stepping outside of yourself. But it should happen at every level. It shouldn't just happen. The leaders shouldn't just be doing it. It shouldn't just be HR's responsibility. It should be everyone's. And so for me, the future of DEI is making it accessible to everyone, harnessing that power of people recognizing that diversity is actually, it's a reality and it actually isn't going away. And we should be leveraging it for gain and for making everyone reach their full potential is the way forward. And Gen Z's definitely modeling that, which is great. And then I guess just it's almost like a world where we actually don't need to be talking about it as much as we are now in terms that people don't quite understand because everyone's practicing it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice? Mm. We don't have to have the conversation because it's just everyone goes, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I would love to actually, you know, I'm not in the space as a job, but it's an area I'm very keen to move into and, you know, work in a way in which I can, or at least as part of my job, which I do already. But I would love, for example, to be out of a job for that reason, because it's suddenly become common practice and everything. And I think with Gen Z, it will start. And I think you touched on this before, Darsh, and I wanted to run with it a bit, but so I might do that now. But you talked about how in the workplace and how I introduced myself as, you know, a person of color and a second-generation migrant and a proud gay man. I think what's really critical is we need to start acknowledging that lived experience is just as important as education and qualifications and skills. I think the way we see the world and the way we approach it, the way we engage with others is so much informed by who we are inside, not inside, but it's who we are as people. So how we've grown up and how we were raised and who formed our values and who formed what we really believe in, because that is how we engage with others in the workplace, because we approach things with a certain mindset and a certain outlook, and that isn't informed by books. So you don't go to university to, you know, I didn't go to university to get a Bachelor of Iron, you know.
Yeah.
I grew up as who I am, and that lived experience is so powerful, yet it's not given the same, nowhere near the same recognition as qualification, skills, or education. And being, you know, working in the space of academia and tertiary education, I know for a fact that, you know, academics are continually measured against the number of grant applications, grants they've held, the number of PhD students they supervise or have completed, number of publications they've got out there. These are all, you know, measures that are metrics that can be measured. And then they're also judged on, you know, what qualifications they have, if they have a PhD, and it's, none of it speaks to, well, you know, we want to give them this promotion because they actually, you know, collaborate really well with others, and or they bring a really diverse viewpoint because they were raised in this way and we like what they have to say. And so I think lived experience is so important, and that, again, is how it will also, I think, help break down privilege, because we will be recognizing others' lived experience as valid and of value. So we will be looking outside of ourselves and looking at someone else and what they have to offer as a person and as their identity versus what they just have a piece of paper that says that they've got a degree in.
Yeah.
You're sharing your soul and your essence. That's literally what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right.
Which a lot of people are scared to share.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because I think we hide behind those qualifications and we become the what first and the who second.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, look, for a lot of people who are disadvantaged, they will use the what because they know that's the only language and the only kind of things they can use that will get people to listen and hear them.
Mm.
So a woman of color, if she gets a professorial position, will then need to use that to demonstrate that she is of value and she's worth listening to.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, like someone who, whereas a white man, unfortunately, I think doesn't have to necessarily do that because he's already in a position where people do listen to him because he's a white man.
And that's, you know, one of the reasons where I think for me, when I got promoted to associate professor, I was like, this title matters. This title matters because people will listen to me now. Yeah, I think the emphasis on what is where we're all at, but to bring in the who, as you said, and the lived experience is incredibly powerful. And we've just got to work out the language of doing that, because in healthcare, we talk about the humanization of care and seeing the patient so you don't, go, oh, so in the stent in room 405, you say this person in this room. I feel like we need to bring the humanization into the workplace so that we see the person first as opposed to everything else.
Yeah, because it also speaks to, I think, in you refer to healthcare, which is great, the humanization, but there's that slogan, which is, you know, nothing about us without us.
Yeah.
You know, which is for consumer advocates, they that's something they hold as true, and I think it's very apt to this conversation, because I think someone's lived experience very much informs who they are, but also it should be listened to and seen as valid and of value, so then they can feel more comfortable engaging, and you can help them in the best way possible. And again, it comes back to the concept of respect.
You know,
respecting them for who they are, not for what qualification they hold and what value they bring as a unique individual.
Could you imagine if workplaces did that, the richness of that and what could possibly be achieved? I mean, the possibilities are exciting to think about.
Yeah, the untapped potential is huge.
Yeah, it's huge. Who wouldn't want that? Seriously.
I know. And I think it's just shifting the paradigm. Like, it's going to take a lot. Like, it's going to take a while, but I think it's slowly happening bit by bit. But I think we need more champions in positions of power and privilege to help it along. DEI advocates, as I said before, most of whom are actually already people who have experiencing disadvantage or coming from groups that have, can only do so much.
Mm.
Then there needs to be the champions at the more senior levels, the ones with the power, the ones who hold the purse strings, to actually go, actually, no, we want to help you. We want to listen to you. Tell us what you need, and we will make systemic change, or we'll make little changes or big changes, but we will make it happen over time. But yeah, and then recognizing, you're right, that imagine if you could, you're exactly right. Imagine the potential if everyone could actually be themselves and bring their unique skills and experience.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
It would be extraordinary.
So powerful.
Yeah.
Be so, so powerful.
Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.